here. I'm mostly a biologist. And I wanted to give this talk mostly as a way to say thank you to the folks who have contributed to Postgres. I use Postgres day in, day out for the last 2 years. I'm thrilled with it. It's made my life easier. And frankly, that's not something you can say about a lot of code that I use. Usually it makes my life harder, if anything. So thank you to the Postgres folks. What I'm going to tell you about today is a schema that I've come up with to help me take on my primary job, which is really to try to find novel therapeutic targets for Genentech to work on. So that's why a biologist is giving a talk at USCON. There we go, that's what I wanted to see. So the outline is that. So basically, I'll tell you a little bit about how drugs are found. Obviously, not a lot, but just enough to give you enough background to explain what I'm doing. And then I'll tell you a little bit about this schema that I came up with, again, called Unison. It's called Unison because it brings a lot of data together, which is something that people in the field have a hard time doing. Particularly, I should emphasize that what I do is computational prediction of targets, not experimental. I used to be an experimental biologist, worked at a bench, and decided a long time ago I liked computers more than I liked. I like boxes more than I like bugs, I guess. So predict a lot of properties about proteins and then use that to fish for new proteins that are going to be therapeutically interesting. And I'll show you a real-world example of how this goes. And then finally, I'll finish off with some issues, things I like about Postgres, you know, problems using Postgres and Oracle Shop, that kind of stuff. Okay. So this is a typical drug pipeline. Obviously, it's just cartoon, but it's enough to sort of hopefully get people thinking in the right area. When drugs are found, you probably have heard people say this, it's a lot of press, you know, pharmaceutical companies spend a lot of time finding targets that go nowhere, therapeutic possibilities that go nowhere. And that's my job, really. I look for new targets, new things for us to work on. And when I find something, there are probably 600 people at Genentech who work just on this area, discovering targets to work on. Those get validated, make sure that they really attack the disease that we're interested in. People try to design drugs to it. That goes into something called preclinical trials. That is, before we ever try it in people, we make sure it does what we think it does and doesn't have any adverse consequences. And then eventually send those into clinical trials that I think all of you have heard about at some point or another, and then finally into production. So again, this is really my job and the job of 600 people at Genentech, trying to find new targets. And it's a big process. As I say here, it takes something like 5 to 10 years to go from a target out here in the discovery area all the way through a company until you actually get a drug out at the other end. I keep doing that. I promise I won't go backward before every slide. Okay, so just to give you a sort of a tangible example of this, and I don't want this to be a marketing talk, but I had to pick an example, so here it is. Kind of how drugs work, what makes them click in the first place. So one of Genentech's drugs is called Herceptin. It's actually an antibody, which is kind of cool for another reason, but it's one of the first therapeutic antibody. So your body makes antibodies to try to fight diseases. Genentech figured out a way to use the same mechanism that your body used to clean up foreign agents and administer that exogenously, that is, through intravenously in this case, and give that to people, and in this case, fight breast cancer. A third of breast cancers, so here's a normal cell, a normal breast cancer cell. Here's the nucleus, the cell wall, and you get these things called receptors that stick out here. Receptors do almost what they sound like. They take an exogenous signal, it attaches, in this case, something called some IGs, doesn't matter, transduces that signal through the cell, and that's how cells talk to one another. So the problem is that in cancer cells, for reasons that aren't quite understood, you get a lot of these. So about one-third of breast cancers are marked by cells that have a very large number of this protein called HER2 overexpressed on the surface. Genentech figured that out, designed an antibody to it. When women take this antibody, it attacks specifically these overexpressing HER2 cells and the body then recognizes this bound antibody as being a foreign agent and comes in, the normal sort of scavenger process takes over. So this, the real point of this though is the neat bit about all of this slide, how a protein like HER2 becomes a target, is that somebody recognized this protein sits on the cell surface, has something that we think we can design an antibody to, and is expressed exclusively on breast cancers, or at least a subset of breast cancer tissues. Okay, so what is a protein? Here's a cell, right? Not always a box, but in this case it is. A cell, a nucleus. Inside the nucleus is your genome, DNA. Through a magical process called transcription, that DNA, a short little message off DNA, is transcribed into another molecule called RNA. That RNA is exported out of the nucleus through a very magical process. That RNA is translated into protein. So what you really should take from this is that proteins are encoded by the DNA. But the really neat bit about proteins is that they fold into essentially unique three-dimensional structures. So imagine taking a necklace that has, you know, beads on a string or something, you throw that into on a table, you'd never expect to see the same structure every single time you did that. You do that with a protein, you see it every time. It folds that way in anywhere from on the microsecond time scale up to maybe a second or two. That's a really slow folder. So that's a pretty miraculous process. And the most important bit of that, the reason that biology works at all, is because proteins can find that structure very quickly, and that structure influences what it does in life. So whether it's collagen in your skin that's got this triple braided helix form that, you know, looks just like rope that makes it very strong, or whether it's an enzyme that catalyzes, you know, the meat that you had or whatever you had for the vegetarians, I'm sorry, and for lunch, you know, that's all a process of proteins with some function, part of your skeletal structure, or part of the metabolism that's going on right now. So, just to give you an example of that, mostly because, you know, pictures with slides are kind of cute, and because I titled the talk with structural biology, so you expect to see a structure, I guess. But here's this sequence of amino acids, right? This just linear string, right? Makes it very easy to compute on. This protein is called trypsin, and this is actually one of the several families of related enzymes that digest proteins. So this long sequence folds into this structure that I show in gray, and I've highlighted three residues and indicated them here. I probably should have colored these yellow too. But anyway, those three residues, it's fair to say that this, all this stuff in gray, it really exists to hold these three residues in just that position. And that's because of the chemistry that it does. It doesn't matter. But that's just an example of what structural biologists look at. They see a sequence like this, that sequence folds into a structure, and part of figuring out what a protein does is looking at this structure and comparing that with other known structures. And just to sort of, you know, again, structural biology, here's an example. There are something like, depending on how you count, something like 7,000 proteins known. They all adopt various folds. Here I just took, you know, a diverse set of them. These are cartoon representations. This is what a protein really looks like. Fill the atoms in space, what's called space filling. This is what it looks like. And speaking of space, proteins actually have very little space in their interiors, unlike what you might infer from the cartoon drawings. Okay, so with what I just said, that, you know, I've shown you that you can determine structures experimentally. That's great. You can and that structure determines its functions, so you might say, why not just determine the structures of all proteins? And that's, you don't need computational prediction, you can determine it experimentally. And this is essentially half of the answer. The green line is the rate of growth of entries into a sequence database called GenBank. And the red line is the rate of growth of structures in a database called the PDB. This is log scale, right? So you can see that we are learning about new sequences much faster than we are learning able to determine structures, right? So what this says is either we need to figure out how to determine structures more readily, and that's not going to happen for a lot of reasons, or we need to do a better job of predicting so that we don't have to experimentally determine structures. By the way, I should have said at the beginning of the talk, feel free to just shout out questions whenever you have them. Okay, shoot.
Is a PDB experimentally?
Yes, PDB. Structure? Almost exclusively. There are exceptions, so.
What percentage of structures are able to be predicted before you discover them?
That's a pretty hard question to answer. The nature is not a very good inventor. It's actually much better at copying things that it knows how to do and then mutating that. So that's the way, that's essentially one of the mechanisms of evolution. You copy a gene, and then now those two genes evolve separately, and one of them may evolve new function. So the answer to your question is that some families, you know, derived from a single ancestor are very easy to crystallize. Others are very difficult. And it turns out that particularly the ones that lie in the membrane of a cell surface are extremely difficult to crystallize. And in fact, essentially, there are a handful of examples, all very poor, the pictures I showed give you the impression that experimental structures are determined with exact precision. In fact, they're not. There's noise in there. So many of the recalcitrant families of proteins where there are structures known are known at very poor resolution. Okay, so hopefully that all sets up sort of the importance of being able to mine for proteins computationally. And come back to this example of HER2. It could be any protein. I just chose this because it will foreshadow earlier. So here's this protein, HER2, sitting on a cell surface. And what I really want to give you an impression for is the kinds of things that one might predict about such a protein, because that's obviously, those lead to clues about its function. So here you've got a protein sitting across the membrane. You can determine, in this case, it has one functional domain, but proteins often have a cascade of things on the outside, and you can predict many of them. And so here's just one example. Another sort of bit of information one can compute, or at least predict, is the localization of this protein. It turns out that there are these things called signal sequences that target the presence of which causes proteins to be secreted and localized to a membrane, in this case. So you can predict those. In fact, there are actually several such sequences, and you can do a variety of prediction of this form to figure out where a protein might be. And then there's a lot of other information that I haven't incorporated yet into Unison, probably won't actually, because it's beyond what one person can do. But there's what's called expression information. People have, it's sort of almost a mini revolution that probably got lost in the announcement of the Human Genome Project. But it turns out you can take cells, split them up, and experimentally determine the expression of particular genes in a particular cell type. And that's, if you have enough such data, that's extremely powerful. You can take, say, normal liver tissue and hepatic cancer tissue, liver cancer tissues. Do this on a bunch of patients, so you get a good sampling of patients of both camps. And then you can say which genes are upregulated or downregulated in cancers. And that's just one example. You can do this for a large number. We subscribe to a service. We must have probably 6,000 different samples of that form that we can fish from. And so obviously, if you could somehow ask, which proteins have this domain, have a signal sequence, and are upregulated in cancer, well, that's that gets you a long way toward figuring out which proteins you think you might be interested in. So, and of course, there's a bunch of other information. When association with disease, it probably is counterintuitive, but oftentimes you will know that this protein is related to a disease, but you have no idea what it does, where it is, or anything like that. Pathology, which is sort of related to the expression of where it sits and what kinds of diseases it causes. And then, of course, literature. By literature, I don't mean Faulkner. I mean experimental scientific literature. It's just I remember when I started grad school, I thought, why are they calling this literature? But anyway, it's what people in the field call the scientific body of knowledge. Okay. Excuse me, I talked kind of fast, which means I get a little parched too. But so, in fact, you should feel free to tell me to slow down too. Okay, so the way people often have tried to mine for sequences is what I'm terming here the old-fashioned way, which probably is a little more disparaging than I intended. But in any case, you have a bucket of sequences of some form, and really that, in the majority of cases, that's just a big file with a bunch of sequences in it. And you write a script, you know, typically in Perl. There's a guy actually who wrote was part of the Human Genome Project, who wrote a program called How Perl Saved the Human Genome Project. So I kid you not, Perl is very important to people in biology, as is Python and others, but Perl in particular. And then you end up with a bunch of candidates, right? So, I mean, it's almost like grep, you know, of a special variety. So this is the way people used to, and still really, think about mining for sequences. Take a bunch of sequences, run it through a filter, and you get a bunch of candidates out. But, and I did this for a while. The problem with this is multifold. The first is, you write this filter for a particular problem. So you're looking for one kind of protein, say, and you write a specific filter. You can't use, you know, you can modify a little bit or whatever for another problem, but it doesn't really get you away from the fact that you've got, now you've forked your code in order to, you know, do a different filter that's probably trivially different. This is a big one. These results are not reused. So if you want to go mine for a different family, you often end up recomputing the same data over and over again. And we have people still doing this. In fact, doing it a lot, taking weeks, literally weeks of computer time each to compute exactly the same thing because it was just too difficult for them to share data. It's difficult to change the criteria often. So, you know, this filter is usually parameterized because a lot of I think it's a little counterintuitive to people who deal with computers, but a lot of biologists, it's almost one of the main differences in a way between computer scientists and biologists. I think a clash of cultures. Biologists are very used to dealing with probabilistic data, you know, things that are very fuzzy and for which you can only describe it as kind of a gut level and not numerically. It's not, they're not computable. So that's, these scripts tend to be, you know, parameterized by, say, the probability that a sequence belongs to some functional family, for example. Then, after the fact, it's hard to exactly know why exactly a sequence was selected if this is a complex filter. And finally, and actually almost most importantly, it's very difficult to keep this up to date because somebody gives you a new file with, you know, 100,000 more sequences in it than your last file, which had a million sequences in it. Oftentimes that file doesn't even have, has redundant sequences, you know, literally identical sequences because they come from multiple sources and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so you end up with this problem of staying up to date as new sequences become available. So obviously this is a Postgres talk, so clearly I'm going to shove all of this into a database, and it's not the end of the story, so don't go anywhere yet. But I'm sort of describe this approach in a database in a couple of slides. First, imagine a space in which you've got, you know, sequences down one side and a bunch of features, things you can compute about a protein sequence on another slide. And the way people often, you know, me included in the previous slide, would look for targets is to do essentially this sequence analysis slice, is the way I think of it, you know, across the matrix. You just take this sequence, you know, number 400,000, and, you know, run an analysis, and if you hit anything here, you store it. You know, and you do that again and again and again and again, right? So pretty soon you've got a bunch of data, and you've thrown it all away, and finally, you know, and then you finish. But clearly what makes more sense is to store this all in a database, and then mining, really, instead of being a filter, is really just a select statement where you say, I'm interested in this feature and this feature and this feature, and you just take a slice, right? You take a slice vertically, do the join, say which sequences show up in, say, all three of the slices. And if you index this right, that becomes a very, very fast operation. And one of the things that, so there are a lot of things that this gets you. First, you can integrate results of a lot of different forms, and I'll show some of those on the next slide. Importantly, you can reuse sequence computation. So not just from one run to the next, but between people even. And finally, and I'd say from sort of the macroscopic, you know, what does Genentech get out of this, is this bit that it becomes much easier for people to generate new hypotheses about what kinds of sequences ought to belong to a functional family, and then generate new hypotheses, new candidates for drug discovery. Okay, so I'll show you the real schema on the next slide, but it's scary enough that I decided I should probably take this in pieces. And this is supposed to mimic what I just showed you. Sequences on the previous slide. Sequences down the left, and things that I call models. That is, and you should really just think about these as types of features. So, you know, one of these might be a structure of a protease, just nod politely, or a structure of an IG domain, or this is a probabilistic model of another IG domain or some such thing. So just types of things that a scientist might be interested in. And then the intersection of these two points, of course, is where a sequence aligns to a particular model, right? So again, sort of take a look at that, and if you kind of blur your vision, it would look like, you know, this matrix a little bit, sequences and features / models. Okay, and this is sort of one of the first places that really got me attracted to Postgres, the ability to inherit tables, and I make a lot of use of that throughout Unison, but particularly here. That is, there's this idea of an alignment. You take a sequence and you match it to a model. And there are lots of ways you can do that, but there are also some very, you know, in an object-oriented sense, there's some abstract features of that that you want to be represented in an abstract class, an abstract table. And so that's what this stands for, protein alignment. It doesn't, you know, all the labels are probably almost distracting. But anyway, so there's this generic alignment table, and now here's a subclass of this alignment to something called a hidden markup model. And here's one to a, doesn't matter. And so you get the kind of same, this is a relationship, allows you to look at the details by doing a select in one of these tables, but also to broaden your focus a little bit and say, show me everything that this sequence aligns to from any table. And for those of you who don't know this, Postgres, when you do a select on a super table, whatever, and you get a union select of all of the subtables. So that allows you to see the abstract features of an alignment as well. Okay, so here is the schema. Obviously, I don't intend you to read this, but I will just sort of point at things, and again, you can nod politely at the kinds of things that it stores. So, first, I put sequences in the database, which is, believe it or not, a really hotly debated issue in the department. But anyway, sequences are in the database. A bunch of information that tells me which source database this sequence came from, these sequences came from, and what they were called in that database, and I even version it. And the reason for doing that is that there are a lot of sources of data of protein sequencing projects. So therefore a lot of sources of proteins, but obviously a lot of people are discovering the same proteins, just the way it is. So I want to be able to store proteins uniquely in one table, but know where I got them and when I got them. And that's important for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is sort of IP and intellectual property concerns. Plus it turns out sequences change names. So anyway, all of that is sort of archived there. I've got the notion of sets of sequences. And then everything in gray here, this is that ISA, right? So here's a feature and alignment tables, and then everything as you move right from those is a something to its left. Doesn't matter. Same thing with those models down here, and then sets of models. So that's really to prove to you that, you know, basically I have a schema.
Why was there an objection to storing the sequences? Proprietary interest?
No, it's... light answer to that question. frankly, I think it was kind of a 1980s attitude. You know, it was what they were told in the 1980s, and so it must still be true. And so the rationale, I can explain why people thought this. a lot of sequences, especially genomic sequence. I'm dealing with only protein sequence, but a lot of genomic sequences are very large. Your genome is 3 billion bases, right? So in not such distant past, storing 3 billion sequences or even a fraction of that in fragments was not an operation that a lot of databases like to deal with. And you know, storing big blobs like that was just not a good way to retrieve data. And that was the answer that was presented to me. I'm not sure I didn't buy it, you know, even probably wouldn't have bought it 10 years ago, but anyway, that was the concern. In practice, the utility is so much, anyway, I can't tell you how many headaches I've had over that conversation, but anyway. So it's shown you a bunch of things that probably have not made a lot of sense, you know, until you spend time with it. So I'd just like to summarize what Unison really is. It's a database that's got a bunch of non-redundant, unchanging sequences, and that's important because once I compute data on a sequence, obviously if the sequence changes, I have to throw away all the pre-computed results. So it's very important that I could guarantee that a sequence not change, and you know, just as a sort of plug for Postgres, that's why I didn't choose other databases, you know, that don't allow me other open source databases, say, you know, why wouldn't I needed to be able to have triggers and in this case server-side functions that I wrote in part that allow me to eventually call an MD5 checksum on these sequences and guarantee that that's unique, so that if a sequence ever comes into the same MD5, I know that I've already seen it, and that would have been impossible to do on other places, including, it turns out, Oracle. Oracle makes it very hard to write functions in C on the back end unless you know you go to Oracle school for a while. And actually talked at length with a consultant about that. And just for comparison, I had Postgres and that function written in a day, right? I went from untarring the tarball to having the server-side code to guarantee the uniqueness done in a day, which you know I couldn't have done, I think, in Oracle. I don't even know where to start. Then I've got a bunch of pre-computed results of various types, you know, basically all the things that I'd ever want to be able to use as criterion for pulling out a sequence. Pretty importantly, I've got bookkeeping, so I can tell you, yes, I did run this analysis on a sequence, so that differential updates, you know, as new sequences roll in, I can say, oh, this sequence hasn't been done, this one hasn't been done, and so forth. Integrated patent info, which is kind of handy. I can take targets, say, okay, here are all the targets I would have fished out, now throw away everything that has a patent associated with it, or even within, you know, some fuzz factor of a patent. So a bunch of auxiliary data, which I won't go into, and a web front end, which you know eventually becomes important when you want to look at a small list of candidates. Okay, so Reality Mining, a new show. This is a cartoon that always reminds me of sort of you know what I think is most important about Unison. And that is a bunch of pre-computed, right? The big picture is I want to make asking questions, answering questions, less painful, right? It should be something fast and something that doesn't kill you like this would. You know, I still get a chuckle out of this when I see it in my office. So anyway, a bunch of pre-computed data and I can ask questions very quickly. Now let's put this to a test. And this is a real example. I had a guy that worked with me. I asked him to spend a couple of months on fishing out sequences and making some database changes that make all of this possible. But the initial sort of take on, so anyway, family of proteins called ITIMs, ITIM-containing proteins. And again, this is a receptor, right? Here's a cell. Something binds to this IG domain that causes a structural wiggling, let's say, through the cell membrane, eventually resulting in a residue, an amino acid that sits right up here in this ITIM motif, this ITIM. To get what's called phosphorylated, chemically altered. So that small change causes the recruitment of a bunch of other proteins that interact with it and cause a cascade of reactions inside the cell. You know, really a pretty cool thing. But particularly cool because it turns out, as you might guess from immunoreceptor, they mediate immune responses in various forms. And that is something that Genentech is particularly interested in. So we are interested in finding other molecules, as you know, as I said earlier in response to a question, nature doesn't really invent very often, it just copies. So it turns out there are a lot of these in your body. And we'd like to make sure we find all of them, because they give you a clue about how the body signals immune responses. So this all becomes really easy, right? Once somebody shows you this picture, this becomes your model. This becomes what you use to go fetch new sequences. And here's what it looks like, right? You've got an IG domain, something called a transmembrane domain that anchors it in the membrane, and the ITIM motif. And so when I saw this, I literally went back and within 5 minutes, coded up this query and found that indeed this query recovers 35 of the 37 known ITIMs that I had a list of. And then I understand why I missed the two that I missed, and they're no fault of mine. They just happen to belong to the family, and I don't really fit this model, so there's nothing I can do about that. But here's the query. This is supposed to show you how easy it is to ask this kind of question. I've got three things I want to align. I can select from three tables that all have this kind of information in them and some criteria about exactly what I want. This, for instance, is a probability associated with this IG domain. And then you can even add some ordering criteria, right? That you require that this TM be upstream of the ITIM, and the IG is upstream of the TM, and so forth. Okay, so right, I did that really quickly, got this response back in 46 seconds, which obviously depends on machine stuff. I don't care to benchmark that with you, because the comparison is that there was a woman who spent 2 months doing this. Right, did 2 months computing all the data for this. So it doesn't even matter what machine you run on. I could run it on my TRS-80 and I'd still do better. So so I don't really have a TRS-80 anymore. Okay, so with that question is answered. So now let's take the other two. And in a way, this question two is the one that I find most interesting, right? Because I just told you that a canonical ITIM is this IG plus a TM plus an ITIM. Okay. Nature, this IG domain has a lot of relatives, and we can turn the question around, right, and actually use this as a way to generate hypotheses. Namely, give me a histogram of what's upstream of a TM and an ITIM, right? So that's what this query does. It's a view, so you can't see all the details, it doesn't matter, right? This is a ranked list of what occurs upstream of these two, which allows me to turn the problem completely around, and it turns out I pull out this thing called a fibronectin type 3. Doesn't matter what that is, except take my word for it, that is structurally very close to this IG domain, right? So when I saw this, I thought, aha, maybe nature has appropriated a very related module in place of this IG domain, and that can be used as a criterion. So to answer that question, and another question which I'll describe in the slide, ran IG domains and fibronectin 3. I selected, from all the sequences I knew about, proteins that contain IG and fibronectin 3s, this TM and an ITIM, and get these hits over here. So the other question that's very interesting is it turns out there's actually another completely different method for predicting IG and fibronectin 3 domains, and that's actually to predict the structure of them. You can computationally predict which the structure that they'll adopt in that area. And so that's a completely different type of method. One of the things we're interested in is how does this method do compared to this one? We expect it to be more sensitive. It takes a lot longer, but that's not a big deal. Anyway, and so here's the result. And as I say, because it's more sensitive, you expect more hits. So because this is all in a database, in fact, we've got views of these things. They run very fast. You can just do a very quick Venn diagram, a PSQL prompt, for example, to figure out the overlap of these things. And you can even remove known members of the family, so that now I'm looking at only the novel members, novel putative members of this family. And then if I just take one of these 51, I'll show you that on the next page, mostly as a way to kind of show you where I take things like this next. We've got this web interface. This is the summary page for this sequence. We've got all kinds of information that I won't take you through, but except to show sort of three blow-ups of other kinds of information. So first, you can click on a tab up here, and it shows you the genomic locus. And one of these sequences is the one that I used as the query that is actually represented over here. And it turns out this protein has what are called isoforms, different forms that are in the same region in the genome. So you see all of those right there. So that's actually a big long stretch of your DNA, here's some gene sitting on it. Here's a list of the sources, how I know about this sequence. So, you know, the names of the databases they came from, what it was called in that database, and then links out to those databases, which often have more information. And then I think one of the neatest things for me is, you know, a former structural biologist, is that I can go from all of these features. This is a this is BioPearl graphic stuff. Features tiled onto the sequence. The sequence is up here, and then here are a bunch of things I know about the sequence of various types. If I click on one of these things, I can on the fly regenerate the structure prediction and show that, and the color coding here tells me the reliability of the alignment that I'm seeing. So this is taking a sequence whose structure isn't known, on the fly generating a structure prediction, and then colorizing it in a way that allows me to assess whether I think that's a plausible alignment or not. Very quickly, since I'm running out of time, Postgres in an Oracle shop. You know, sort of the bad news I'd say first, it's really hard to get people to try this. I found that to be the most daunting thing. These are people, I work in something called the bioinformatics department, people who have a lot of experience, you know, with computers of some form. But frankly, I think they do not have the sort of intrepid spirit of people who were willing to go out and, you know, download a tarball and just try some code just to try it. And that's true of just tools. You know, I can tell people, you know, just start up PSQL. Like, trust me, it's better than SQL Plus, you know, and they just don't get that. They're often not willing to try it. So as with a lot of these things, the only real way to get them to do it is to treat this as a meritocracy. You have to show them why they ought to be interested in it and, you know, build it and they will come, I guess, is probably a better way to describe it. Turns out a more pervasive problem is there's just no support for Postgres. I am the Postgres guy at Genentech, and I'm not even a system administrator. So, and on top of that, Postgres is running on a Linux box, which is, you know, until a couple years ago, was quite taboo. So there's just not much willingness to to be careful about how we expose this to the rest of the research community at Genentech. The good news is, though, that there are a few users who have said, oh, that information is really valuable, I need to figure out how to use it. And it turns out it's not as difficult as they thought. I've got a Perl API to the database. There's obviously PSQL, which, as I say, if you can use SQL Plus, you ought to be committed. But, you know, once you get out, you can come use a real interaction shell. And then, sort of more importantly, it turns out the database servers that we do have terrible downtimes. You know, our Linux cluster has uptimes of 10 months, and so telling me about downtime problems, potential downtime problems with the cluster of Postgres is, obviously I just bite my tongue, but I think it's sort of speaking for itself now. And so the upshot of that is that the reputation is building. I think the reputation at Genentech is quite good, largely because the benchmark is so poor.
How do you do your backups?
I do PG dump twice a week, and the database, I'm the only one that loads the database, and I've got multiple readers. So that's been sufficient now. And furthermore, I tend to do the updates sort of in
in between data imports.
No, I do the updates. Since the number of users is small, I don't have to worry about. I don't worry right now about people seeing incomplete data. I do have actually a product. I should call it a stable database. That is the and then I just sort of cycle between a development. I load into a dev database and then cycle that over via dump and restore into a production database. And so if people really care about what's in the whether they're seeing sort of half complete pictures, then they can use the stable database. Yes.
In an FDA regulated enterprise like this, right?
Yes.
Those are very real obstacles, regardless of the technologies, right?
So it turns out that the FDA really doesn't touch people in research.
The discovery phase?
Yeah. It definitely does for preclinical to some extent, and then obviously clinical. But that's fortunately something I don't have to worry about.
So you don't have to deal with that?
Yeah. Yes?
How large is your database?
Say in PG dump size, it's 5.2 gigabytes dumped. Yeah?
How many people do you have using your system?
So I'm a very frequent user. I've got, I would say, a band of maybe sort of 10 infrequent, say once a week users maybe, probably even less, and then, you know, very infrequent users.
So mostly people are using the production system now, or?
No, that's the way somebody who, you know, really thought carefully about it would do it. Right now, frankly,
your commercial system, this is your
yeah, so mostly I point people, I mean, so my job is as a target discoverer. It's not to develop software. This is just a tool for me, right? So typically what happens is I have a joint appointment in protein engineering, and I work a lot with people who are trying to find new targets for us to, say, crystallize because we think the target's very interesting, just as an example. So I will do a lot of mining, say, hey, I think we ought to look at this, and send somebody a link, which is essentially the evidence, you know, why I think this target's interesting. And invariably, I did some development in order to, there was something that I wanted to show that the stable database couldn't do. So I end up pointing them to sort of the dev side because it's got, you know, more recent data, more recent web pages, whatever. Okay, so some of the features I've loved, I think I've touched on most of these, except for Kerberos. We use Kerberos and LDAP, but I particularly like Kerberos. You know, it gets me out of the password, you know, what's my password today game. And then some of the things I'd love to see out of the Postgres community. The first is, I can't say that I could get Genentech to put money into Postgres, but I would certainly push for a couple features that I've wanted. If there were a way for me to target money to specific features, and you know, and here are a couple of them. One is table inheritance. It turns out doesn't inherit the indices on them. So if you have, anyway, if you know about the problem, you know that it's a problem, and I won't take up time to describe it. Problem is a little strong, but anyway, it's a, you know, probably not intuitive. There's a lot of chatter on news groups about it. And then, because we're an Oracle shop, I'd really like to see some variant of this. I realize that the general solution to this is really hard, but that's not what I want. I want, you know, say, just read-only access to and from an Oracle database. I want Oracle users to be able to see Postgres data, or vice versa, or both. And that, I think, is not so much different than a better interface on top of DB-Link, for those of you who know about that. As an example, and correct me if I'm wrong, if somebody, you know, has a really insightful reason why that's, you know, that is a brain-dead idea, but I think it's doable. Okay, so end of the talk. Here are some acknowledgments. Obviously, this talk was essentially to thank the Postgres folks. Again, not many times that people make my life easier, and so thank you to all of them for that. Use a lot of free software stuff. Here's some free software scientific programs that you folks might want to know about. Data that you can, you know, plug into these programs, and then Genentech for being a great place to work. In particular, a guy that just left, but reported to me and was pretty helpful with this project. And I'd be happy to take any more questions.
So with regards to crystallizing the proteins in the membrane, mm-hmm. is it just that the lipids are just inherently too, well, liquidy to freeze fracture, or?
The problem, I mean, I don't think anybody knows exactly what the problem is, but I suspect it's the following. So for those of you who didn't follow that, the question is why are membrane proteins harder to crystallize? These are these big, typically very big proteins that sit in a bunch of fat. And when they, you know, all of you know that oil and water don't mix. So same thing, a protein that sits in the membrane is very oily, right? It's got a lot of hydrophobic, as it's called, fearing water, groups on the outside, and it turns out the proteins of that form tend to be pretty sticky. That is, when you put them in water especially, they tend to just aggregate because they're trying to hide, trying to bury as much surface as they can from water. So that's the answer to your question, most I suspect. Anything else? Yes?
Can you attack that same problem from a computational side? As opposed to experimental? What you're talking about is experimental, no? Those are artifacts of the method used to extract the protein, right? Couldn't you model it through some computational method as opposed to?
You mean actually try to predict the structure of such proteins?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean? No, usually.
Well, no, isolate them. What you refer to crystallizing?
Probably not. I mean, there's no, I don't, you know, at the end of the day, you need a tangible protein in order to crystallize. So the way structure determination works, there are two basic methods. The one we're talking about here is you take a protein, you get enough of it, so that, and then put it in a very small well, and it will, many times, in the right circumstances, crystallize, which specifically means you get a single crystal. So to a physical chemist, that means you get a repeating lattice of the same thing that you can then put in an X-ray beam. And it turns out that when you shine an X-ray beam into a crystal, if you know sort of the angle that it's coming in and you collect the diffraction pattern that's coming out, and then you rotate the crystal, you collect a bunch of diffraction patterns, it turns out you can back compute what the structure must be for that diffraction pattern. All of which means you need this tangible thing, a crystal, to actually determine the structure. Anything else? Okay.